WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina. This is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Sydney Penney launched her career in entertainment by striding onto a stage while the performers were taking a break, grabbing the microphone, and singing a song. She was 3.5 years old. The actual musical entertainers that night were her parents, who decided to go with it, and an actor was born. She booked her first commercial when she was about 6 years old, then gained international attention by age 10 in the wildly popular television adaptation of The Thornbirds. She went on to star opposite Clint Eastwood in Pale Rider, still barely a teenager. As an adult, she became known for her portrayal of Julia Santos Kiefer on All My Children, and later as Samantha Kelly on The Bold and the Beautiful. Sydney Penney has been nominated twice for Daytime Emmy Awards. She's won a Soap Opera Digest Award as well as 2 Young Artist Awards. And it was 1997 that she first came to Wilmington, North Carolina to film Enchanted, a movie written and directed by Wilmington native John Ward. 2 years later, she returned as Wilmington's Azalea Queen. It only took another 6 years for Sydney Penney and her husband, Robert Powers, to decide to make Wilmington home. They've lived in the Port City since 2005. They have 1 child, and in 2016, they bought Jester's Cafe, what they describe as a boutique bistro, in the Castle Street Arts and Antiques District. She joins me now. Sydney Penney, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much, Rachel. I'm really happy to be here. I so like your work.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's such a pleasure to have you here. Long overdue, I might add. So your first time on stage happened when you were a toddler. Take us back to that day or that evening in the bar, club, restaurant.
Well, it's a very dim memory. It's an awfully long time ago. But there's certain bits about it I really do remember. One of them was I felt like I needed a stage name because I was on stage. I guess that was all I knew, a stage name. So I called myself Caroline. Ironically, and here I am. And
so this is this 3.5-year-old striding up to the mic while your parents are on a break.
Yeah. You know, my parents would often perform in clubs that were family friendly, and my sister was babysitting me. And I don't know how I slipped away from her, but it just seemed the most natural thing in the world because my parents were on stage all the time. I was comfortable with the concept. So it didn't seem much of a stretch. And I've always said, you know, if my family had been plumbers, I would be wielding a wrench now. It's just what you do. You
know? And so once your parents discovered what was happening, what did they do? How did they handle it?
Well, my dad was first to come up on stage. He said, well, hey, Sydney Margaret, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm performing. And he said, oh, all right, well, what would you like to do? And I said, well, I'd like to sing a song. Okay. What song would you like to sing? I made something up. I think I called it My Little Pony. I loved horses. Still do. He said, well, wonderful. And what key would you like to sing in?
3.5-year-old.
Sure. And I think I said A minor or something random like that. And so he played guitar. My dad was one of the pioneers of Western swing music. So he could obviously play an A minor. And he picked out some chords. And I don't know, I guess I started making up some kind of lyrics about a pony of some sort. And we finished that together. Yeah, I wouldn't let my mom on stage. I told her I was fine. I didn't need her at that time. And afterwards, you know, they said, hey, Caroline, you were great. That was really fun. Did you have a good time? And I said, Caroline is my stage name. You can call me Sydney.
Now,
I could never be this precocious now. I just, just the thought of it is.
So your parents were musical entertainers, but your dad, so we're going to talk later about the fact that he was a pioneer of Western swing, but I'm not, you're writing a musical about him, which is amazing. But your mom was operatically trained and your dad was also a comedian?
Yes.
What kind of comedian was he? What? How do those things go together, being a Western swing musician
sure.
and comedian?
Well, you know, he came from the era when you really wanted to be a triple threat. You know, you had to use all of your talents. And he had an early mentor who taught him really the fine art of comedy, how to hold an audience's attention, how to tell a joke, how to wait for the laugh. He was absolutely stupendous working a room, even if he wasn't doing comedy. People were just drawn to him, to meet him, to talk with him. He never left a place that people didn't feel enriched by his presence, because, you know, he could listen as well as talk. And so the comedy was sort of, he started it out as this old, you know, sort of good old country boy comedy. And then over the years, over the decades, it developed into something a little bit more suave and related to, you know, whatever the times he was in, but always clean, never political, always whatever would bring on board as many people as possible in that room, give them all a chance to enjoy something together. That was his goal. And it was wonderful that way. And that's still, to me, you know, my standard for going into any room. Like, what can we find that we all agree on that will make us all feel good when we all leave this room again? Because that's that was a really rare, beautiful talent that he had.
That's something might serve us all to think about doing more.
Absolutely.
Your dad's comedy, do you remember as a kid thinking, dad jokes? Or, I mean, do you remember, and can you tell us one of his jokes?
Oh, gosh.
Which is really putting you on the spot, I know.
I do remember a lot of them. I could never tell them as well as he could. And strangely, I'm really not good at telling jokes. I do remember some of them were so, so funny. There was one about this guy. He comes in, oh, gosh, it's a long joke. I can't tell this whole thing. But, you know, they were wonderful. And what I learned is, as I watched him, is how he adapted it according to the feedback that he was getting in the room. I knew the jokes really well. I knew how they went, but he'd change his pace. He'd change a little bit of the punch in places because he felt how it was going to land with people. And it was just such an art. Now, I will say my son is talented the same way. He can tell a joke. He can remember them. He gets it. It just it makes the hair on my arm stand up sometime to just see this same kind of magic come out of him.
Your son.
But I think it skipped me.
The recessive genes do that sometimes,
that must
generationally.
Be it, yeah.
So your son is a teenager now?
Yeah.
Is that right?
He's 14.
And is he headed for the entertainment business as a comedian?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I think he's blessed with a lot of wonderful skills. He's also great at math and science. That one skipped me as well. That one definitely skipped me. I don't know. He's gonna have some choices to make, I think. But he does enjoy being on stage. He enjoys performing. He finds the funny too. That's very interesting to me.
So going back to you as a child, your family moved to California when you were around 6 years old.
A little earlier, yeah. We were probably there by the time I began kindergarten.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you started auditioning pretty quickly, pretty soon after you moved there?
Yeah, it was one of those sort of, hey, is this anything you're curious in? You know, you wanna maybe go on an audition? I'll go, okay. I think I just got it. So then after that, it just kept evolving. And I remember the first commercial I did was for a doll called Dancerella. It was a Mattel large doll that was a ballerina that moved and spun. And I remember being on set, and I remember everything about that day. I remember everything about the set. I remember how it smelled, you know, it smelled like dust and cigarette smoke and coffee, which is still probably my favorite smell in the world. and I just remember thinking, wow, I am part of this.
What did you have to do in the commercial?
Not much. You know, I had to sit on a floor. I was wearing a very pretty dress, kind of dressed the same as the doll, and just sit there and function the doll as she spun around and did kicks and things like that. And they just took different shots. And, you know, commercials are strange that way. You never really know what they're going to do with it eventually. But I just thought this was the greatest place that I'd ever been. And all these adults were around, and they were treating me just like one of them. And I still feel the same way. Every time I walk on set, I'm like, look at this place. This is the best place to be. Anywhere. I'm going to get some bad coffee and enjoy this.
By the time you were 10, you grabbed international attention as Maggie in The Thornbirds, opposite Richard Chamberlain, Rachel Ward, and Barbara Stanwyck. How aware were you at 10 years old of what a big deal that was?
Probably not really aware at all. To me, it was a big deal because it was quite a process getting the role. I actually had 7 auditions. The first 2 or 3 or 4 were just with the casting office because they were going through hundreds of girls for this role. And then the last 2 or 3 were with Stan Margulies and David Wolper, the producers. And then Richard Chamberlain was actually, I think, at present at the last audition and read with him. And it was very cool to have accomplished that, but the shoot itself was just so much fun. Just one of my favorite things I've ever done.
Well, we'll hear more about that in just a few minutes. You're listening to Coastline. Actor Sydney Penney is with me today. After this short break, we'll also hear about how she thinks about fame and why she says it's so different from the up-and-coming generation. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Sydney Penney is my guest today. She might be best known for her roles on All My Children as Julia Santos Kiefer and The Bold and the Beautiful as Samantha Kelly, but she started acting as a child with her breakthrough role in The Thornbirds when she was just 10 years old. That was followed by a co-starring role opposite Clint Eastwood in Pale Rider just 3 years later. But Sydney, going back to The Thornbirds, you say that you loved shooting that television miniseries, going on set. Tell us about that. What was it? I mean, aside from just the fact that every time you walk onto a set, you say, this is it. This is where I want to be.
Yeah,
I really do. What was it about The Thornbirds?
It was a pretty magical summer for me. It was right before I turned 11. And we were shooting mostly on the set of Drogheda. And there were horses, and there were just, oh, the cast was amazing, and everyone seemed to have time to enjoy each other and have fun. And the work also was, for me, one of the first times that I felt like I was doing real, serious acting. I had worked very hard with a coach leading up to it. The set itself, there was always such an amazing focus. And while I wasn't necessarily really aware of the full careers of the people that I was working with, I didn't have to be, because as soon as I stood opposite Barbara Stanwyck or Richard Kiley or Gene Simmons or Richard Chamberlain, and I could go on and on with that cast, I saw why they were the stars that they were. They were amazing craftspeople and technicians, creative, but diligent and lighthearted as well. Barbara Stanwyck on that, she nobody could spell her name. It was kind of funny. Has a director's chair. They tried 2 or 3 times, and it kept coming back spelled wrong. And so she,
on the chair,
and so she very graciously took the person aside who was desperately trying to get it right. And she said, look, just put Missy. Just put Missy. That's what everybody calls me. And so that's what her chair said. It just said Missy. And I thought, wow, you know, that's what being a great star really is getting past all of the stuff that people think you have to do to stamp your feet and make sure that people know who you are. She was willing to just be Missy to make, you know, the prop guy feel like he was okay. But, you know, they were wonderful examples to me.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a scene in that series in which, you know, again, going back mm-hmm. to the fact that you're 10 years old, this is a little kid. I mean, you're not even a tween yet. No. You're a little yeah. girl.
Yeah.
And you have to somehow tell Richard Chamberlain's character mm-hmm. that you have your period.
Yeah.
So you didn't when the actor didn't.
No.
Because yeah. you were only 10,
right.
barely 11.
Uh-huh.
So what did you know about that? And what did the adults tell you about it? How did you feel in that scene?
Well, yeah, I had to have it explained to me. I knew the facts, you know, but the actual physical experience that she would be having, that Megan would be experiencing, Maggie. Yeah, I had to pretty much have that explained to me. And then, you know, there's a certain amount of embarrassment. Here I am as a young girl sitting with very handsome Richard Chamberlain having this discussion. But I think the atmosphere of the set and the professionalism of everyone around allowed for that and guided me in how to not feel uncomfortable. I took it very seriously. And I thought, wow, this is, you know, I realized then that what we are handed as actors is someone's story to tell. It doesn't matter if they're a real person or not, but you have to be entrusted with that and you have to tell it the best you can. It really is something you're entrusted with. And it was funny because we shot this scene and it was beautiful. And I remember everything about that rose garden. I remember what it smelled like. I remember the gravel crunching under my feet. I remember the feeling of sitting on the stone bench. I remember the sun. I mean, it's going to always be with me that day because it was such a wonderful moment. And Richard was so generous in working with me. And so when we had the premiere, we had a cast and crew screening of the first 3-hour episode. Pretty neat day. Got to meet Henry Mancini, for one thing, which was awesome.
Did you know who he was at that time?
Yeah, I did.
Of course you did.
I did. That's one of the things I'm really pleased to have met him. What an impact he's had on film. But we reached that point where it was that scene, which was one of the last scenes that I had in that first 3 hours. And the audience laughed. And I thought, oh God, oh, this was a very serious scene and they're laughing. What didn't I do this right? And then I thought about it for a long time and I kind of realized, oh, they're adults. this of course would feel amusing to them because of the innocence of it and the honesty of it. But it did really bother me for a while.
which is understandable.
Yeah, sure.
Because
sure.
so much of that is, I mean, as an actor, you're embodying the reality of that. And
right.
so you're feeling protective about your character.
I had a completely different point of view of every other person on the planet at that moment. And then I went, oh, okay. And now I watch it, of course, and I laugh.
And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of your child actor career, there's this kind of running theme of Sydney, the young girl, being a symbol of innocence, and not Sydney Penny, but the character
yeah.
you're playing,
mm-hmm.
but also being alluring to adult men. And so I want to ask you about that in a second.
Okay.
But first, you're listening to Coastline. Sydney Penny is my guest today. She is known for her roles on All My Children and The Bold and the Beautiful, as well as her work as a child actor in The Thornbirds and the Clint Eastwood film Pale Rider. There is a free screening of Pale Rider this Sunday, October 17th at 4 p.m. at the Point Cinemas. After the film, Sydney Penney will participate in a Q&A session, which I'll moderate, and we hope to see you there. Now, Pale Rider, this film came a couple of years after your experience with the Thornbirds. How did you come to Clint Eastwood's attention?
Well, as I understand it, it was because of Burt Reynolds. Burt actually wrote me a fan letter after the Thornbirds, which I still have. And it, he just said, you know, I'm a few years older than you, but this is just to say you're one of the most beautiful girls on the silver screen. And wow, that's nice.
Yeah.
But I guess Burt and Clint had worked together on City Heat. Is that if I'm getting the title of the film they did together correctly. And Burt had a role that I came in to audition for, but I was really still quite a bit too young for it. But he knew that Clint was getting ready to put Pale Rider together, and so he kind of mentioned my name to him. So when it all came up, I went over to Clint's office at Warner Brothers at Malpaso, and we just kind of sat there on his leather couch in his office, you know, with the casting director and all, and just kind of had a little conversation. He just asked me about my life and about riding horses, because that was my major hobby and love at the moment. And probably talked about baseball. Yep, I'm pretty sure we probably did. My other love. And then that was it, you know, 15, 20 minutes of conversation. And I ended up getting the role. And then off that fall to Idaho to shoot the film.
In this film, your character falls in love with Clint Eastwood's character. And again, let's contextualize this with age. You're about 13.
Yeah.
And you're a very young 13.
I know, but I was playing 15. But yeah.
Okay. So the premise is that your family is in trouble.
Yeah.
There are just a lot of problems, and your dog has just been killed.
Yes.
By invading marauders. You pray for a miracle, and he comes riding in literally on a white horse and seemingly turns things around for the family. Mm-hmm. So it would be improbable for you as a 13-year-old then, or a 15-year-old, not to fall in love with this guy.
Right.
And in fact, you know, the audience falls in love with him. He's the hero of the film. And there's a scene when you tell him you love him and you ask him to make love to you. Okay, so you're 13 and a young 13. So how did Clint Eastwood, who also directed this film, talk to you about how to do this and what your character is thinking? And how did you come at that?
Interestingly, I don't think we ever had a conversation about it. Clint is a brilliant director in every way a director needs to be brilliant, on set with his actors, but also with the crew. He just seems to set a tone and then lets the professionals do their work. And I guess that's kind of the tack that he took on this. I think he was obviously ready to guide as necessary. But I remember it being, it didn't take very long to shoot the scene. And we just did the scene. It's interesting. I don't remember a lot of conversation about it, except where is it going to take place? Where are our marks? Let's go. And it was interesting, because I think what I just fell back on for Megan was her very honest, simple logic, for one thing, because her line, as I recall, is actually, well, if you love someone, then there can't be anything wrong with making love. So she's kind of throwing it out there. But also, she prayed for him. She conjured him. He's in a way imaginary and very, very safe. And if you see the way that he staged it, I think he was very sensitive, very aware of the the context and how it could be perceived. But if you watch him and you watch his body language and you watch how he staged it, you see how aware he was of how it could have been, it could have maybe not come off as well as it did.
It could have been creepy.
It could have been creepy,
but
you, exactly.
But as an audience member, I felt safe for
Megan. Well, you see that he had humor in his eyes as well. You know, he was complimented, but that was not going to happen.
And, you know, one of the things that you talk about as an actor is that you don't have to have direct experience of something to be able to play it. In fact, you've said a scene can actually turn out better if the actor doesn't have that direct experience. Why is that? Where do you go? What are you then drawing on?
I do think that that's true. And I haven't fully thought through why it is, except I think maybe we're a little bit freer in our imagination than feeling like we have to hold to something we've actually experienced. We don't have any loyalty to it. We don't have to replicate it. We are able to grab things that are also maybe unrelated. You know, there have been times when I've been in a scene where I had to have very intense emotions about whatever it is. Maybe it's in the Thornbirds when my brother is going away forever. I never experienced my brother going away forever, anyone going away forever. That's not something I experienced at that age. But it's almost like a Jungian collective unconscious. You know, you can reach out there and grab something that is so universal, and then you can work on finding a way to make it specific and crafting it into something that really conveys whatever needs to be conveyed in that moment for that character.
You also have a scene in which you're about to be gang raped. You're not. Again, as a child in this.
What a heck of a career,
Well,
huh?
This is what I'm, you know, you are the symbol of innocence. That's what's going on.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen, spoiler alert, sorry about that. But it's not that's not really the spoiler in the movie anyway.
No.
So again, a young Sydney processing this, you've said that you felt safe in that context. You know, mm-hmm. as the actor, you never felt like you were going to be harmed.
No, not at all.
But
yeah, of course not.
So what do you think about that now as an adult looking back on it?
You know, I tell you, I've always just gone back to the screenplay. I've gone back to the story, to the motivations that must be there. And as long as those are properly constructed and they're not just to titillate or to, I don't know the word that I'm looking for exactly, if they're not cheapening an actor or the story, but if they really have a purpose, then everything will be in balance. And that will be conveyed in the story. And no, I felt so safe on that set at all times. And I absolutely loved everyone who was there and their support. And I was not nervous about it in any way, except it was a situation I'd never been in, you know. But I'll tell you this, Chris Penn was way more nervous than I was.
One of the actors.
Yes, exactly. He's the actor who had to pull me off the horse and, you know, kind of rough me up a little bit. But it probably was much more tame in the filming of it than the way it ends up being edited as well. And that's the art of filmmaking.
It isn't graphic at all.
No, it's not.
It just suggests what they're after.
And
yes. So the stereotype about child actors is that they wind up abusing substances, alcohol, mm-hmm. drugs, getting convicted of felonies. You avoided all that.
Yes, I have.
How did you happen to dodge the understandable pitfalls that exist for child actors? Why are you okay now?
Well, probably because my parents were very savvy about the business. They were entertainers. They knew what was out there. They knew what to avoid. And that sharpened their instruction to me sharpened my own instincts. I also, you know, if there was an opportunity to do some kind of industry function or to go to my friend's birthday party, the choice was always my friend's birthday party, because I was a child first, and my childhood and my teen years were different than other people's, but they were still very rich with very normal things, which I think is so important, because that's what makes you a human being and allows you to become an adult and then maybe continue acting as an adult and have experiences that will inform forever. But also had the example of peers who did get into all kinds of trouble, either by their own hand, their own decisions, or by other people taking advantage of them. And I continue to see it, you know, you continue to hear things that come out, and my heart breaks for them, because there must not have been a firewall for them between themselves and the menace that is out there. It is not a business for the faint of heart. This is not a business for day trippers. You've got to come in armed and with your eyes wide open.
And when we come back from this next break, I'm going to ask you about what advice you would give to parents who maybe are aware and well-meaning, but perhaps don't know everything they might need to know. You're listening to Coastline. Actor Sydney Penney is my guest today. When we come back from this short break, we'll also find out what else she's creating and hear about her work with Cape Fear Community College. More with Sydney Penney in a moment. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Sydney Penney landed the role that made her famous when she was just 10 years old, Meggie in the television adaptation of The Thornbirds, starring Richard Chamberlain, Rachel Ward, and Barbara Stanwyck. Just 3 years later, she landed a starring role opposite Clint Eastwood in Pale Rider. She went on to acting success as an adult in multiple TV and film roles, including two longer stints on All My Children and The Bold and the Beautiful. And Sydney Penney, just before we went to break, you were talking about what it was like to be a child actor and dodging some of those pitfalls that your contemporaries kind of fell prey to. What would you say to parents who have kids in the business here? What do they need to know that perhaps even well-meaning, aware, educated folks might not know?
Well, that's a great question. It's a tricky business. And it's a little harder now, I think, even than when I was young, because it's so much bigger, and there's so many different forms of media. And it's not a terribly well, I don't know, regulated, I suppose, to use a bad term. I don't know. Like I say, you've got to be a real professional. The parent and child, you have to trust your instincts and be willing to walk away and not be sparkled by fame, because it's just not a business to be trifled with. If you really love it, then learn your craft and act any chance that you get, but don't sacrifice your principles for it or your better judgment. It's never going to be worth it.
You also starred in the 1989 remake of Two Women, or also called Running Away, mm-hmm. I think, mm-hmm. with Sophia Loren, who was in that film, both in the original version and
right.
then again this remake.
Yeah.
She plays your mom, and in this film, I just have to ask this question and then we'll get out of gang raping. But you are gang raped in this film. It's not an attempt. It happens. Right. How did the adults talk to you about that part of the plot and how did they handle it?
Oh, gosh. Well, by this time, I was kind of an old hand at the concept, wasn't I? There's no in the film, there's nothing shown. There is the threat that's quite clear. There are people breaking into a church where these two women are taking refuge. And it's very clear what's going to happen. And then there is the aftermath where they're cleaning up. And there's obviously something that has occurred. And it's impactful. You know, it's very clear what occurred. And this is definitely a moment of transition for the two of them, and for my character, Rosetta, it was a very quick growing up.
Yeah.
Everything up to that had been beautifully innocent, you know, just girlish crushes on a, you know, a cute guy. This just shattered it, and it really feels shattering. Sophia and I had a scene that takes place after she's frantically worried about Rosetta because she's disappeared. And she comes back in and she's dressed in these sort of cheap clothes. And she realizes that she's been out with this truck driver that had given them a lift. And she's mad with worry, but also just wants her to go back to being a little girl. And so this scene, I'm standing there in front of her and she says to me, you know, where were you? And I was out. Where were you with Florinda? Yes, I was. She has to slap me. And so they're shooting this in close-up, and we had kind of done the fake slap, you know. She was taking a little off her right hook, and I was kind of, you know, turning my head to the side a little bit.
There's a protocol for doing
this. Exactly, and we did a couple, and they're like, yeah, it just, you know, it's in close-up because we can really see it just didn't quite work. And so without saying anything to each other, I said, I'm not going to turn my head. I'm just going to let her hit me. And then without saying anything to me, she goes, you know what, I'm just gonna really hit her.
Oh no, those two things coming together.
Yeah.
In the same take.
Let me tell you, it's a great take.
What happened?
Yeah, she slapped me right out of frame. And then when I finally came back, because of course, you know, you gotta finish the scene. That's not where it ends. Eyes filled with tears. You know, it set the tone for the rest of the, you know, afternoon of filming, that's for sure. It just was very, very keyed up. But it was a great take.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's what it takes. And so then her character throws Rosetta on the bed and is thrashing her, you know, basically saying, go back to how you were. Go back to how you were. And I realized the next day, surveying sort of my thigh, she was wearing a very big ring on her hand. So we really went for it there. There was a little.
You got beaten up by Sophia,
Loren for real. Totally beat me up. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's talk about your acting career in your adult years, because a lot of people recognize you from your time on All My Children and your time on The Bold and the Beautiful. What was it like to go from shooting film, where you have one camera, to a soap opera set where you've got multiple cameras?
Wow, it's really different. And it's such a different style of preparing. It's exact 180 degrees opposite. Soaps are shot a little bit more like television now. Then, especially the East Coast soaps, they were shot like a hybrid of theater and television. And
what do you mean when you say
well,
that?
Well, because you're on a stage in a way, and you're moving throughout the set, whereas in television, just it's little chunks. You know, it's an over the shoulder shot, it's a close up, it's a master, and you're just shooting them in little chunks. Well, it's all done in chunks, but it's all done at the same time, so that's why it's sort of like theater and TV put together. But yeah, you know, for the first 3 years or so I was on All My Children, I was shooting about 30 pages of dialogue a day, 5 days a week. So at the end of Friday, I'd gone through 150 pages of dialogue, all of which were emotional. It was exhausting.
Yeah. And of course, mere mortals want to know how you memorize all that.
It's a muscle. It's like anything else. You just get good at it. And it doesn't necessarily change all that much day to day. You know, there's some similarities, which actually ends up being harder because you can't remember if you're doing Thursday script or Tuesday script. But it all comes out in the wash eventually. But, you know, I missed being outside. I missed the kind of the contact with the elements, that unknown. I missed wondering if you're going to end up, you know, having to dodge the raindrops. You know, if I could spend every day on set on a Western on horseback, I would. Like, that's my sort of natural environment, I guess.
A film set.
Yeah.
So you are launching a production company.
Yes.
That's a
big
deal.
Yeah.
So what is its name?
It's called Cucklebur and Company.
And that is a reference to?
The cocklebur plant, which is has these bird fruits on it that stick to everything. And so we are focusing on telling stories that are inspired by the Southern experience. And they'll stick to you. So that's the idea.
You told the Star News in 2013, quote, "The odd thing for me is that I'm often right for roles, but they cast in L.A. And this was something you were talking about after moving here to Wilmington, North Carolina. And you say many of the roles that are cast locally are for smaller roles, not really something I'm going for. So I would almost have to go out to L.A. in some cases to audition to come here and work." Mm-hmm. Is that part of what is driving the production company? And has any of this changed for you? Because that was 8 years ago now.
Yeah. No. I don't know. I haven't actually ever worked here very much. I don't know why. I don't know. And I do think that it's partially because there's still a very LA-centric concept of casting. It's just how it is. And I can't fault them for that. You know, that's where a lot of projects originate, and they want to see somebody right in front of them. You know, there's probably many reasons. But also, you know, I think my life is just naturally taking a different turn, and I'm very happy about that, too. So I don't know. I guess I don't think about it too much anymore.
So with this new production company, what are some of those stories that you want to tell? What stories need to be told?
Oh, you know, I love stories that are really character-driven. Of course, you have to have a fantastic plot, and you have to have a wonderful setting. But, you know, that's what really differentiates the stories that capture you from the ones that you can't remember 3 days later, is that you were able to connect somehow with the experience of those characters. And I think the South has a wonderful way of conveying the human experience that's really unique. It can be warm and loving, but it can be fiery hot, and there can be arrogance and there can be joy. There's a lot of emotion, I think, south of the Mason-Dixon line, and it makes this a very rich place to be. Especially for a storyteller.
You're listening to Coastline. Sydney Penney is my guest today. She might be best known for her roles on All My Children and The Bold and the Beautiful, as well as her work as a child actor in The Thornbirds and the Clint Eastwood film Pale Rider. And as a matter of fact, there is a free screening of Pale Rider this Sunday, October 17th at 4 p.m. at the Point Cinemas. After the film, Sydney Penney will participate in a Q&A session, which I'll moderate. So we hope to see you there. Sydney Penney, you have said that you think differently about fame than the current generation. And when I say the current generation, I guess I mean up-and-comers. What does fame mean to you, and how is that different from the way people seem to think and talk about it and pursue it today?
Yeah, fame to me has always been, a somewhat unfortunate side effect of doing what I love to do. Sometimes it can be great. I mean, I remember I used to fly Continental Airlines, and sometimes I'd get, you know, like a hot fudge sundae if they had one left over. Hey, I love you and all my children. Here you go. Aww. Have some ice cream. But apart from that, it's burdensome. It can be lovely. I probably have gotten to meet more interesting people just on the street, you know, than your average person does, simply because people have an entree. You know, they have a way to say, hi, I think I know you. And so I get to meet a lot of neat people that way. And I do love that. I really like people. But I'm puzzled by what I see now, which is people who seem to reach out with the goal of being famous, but without the connection to what are you going to be famous for, and even beyond that, and what does that activity provide to the world? There's a hollowness to it that I don't understand.
Going back to you as a prolific creative, you're writing a musical now about your dad, Hank Penny, pioneer of Western swing. How is that coming along? Where is it in the process? And are you writing the music? Are you writing the book, the script? How does that work?
I don't have to write the music because it's all taken from my dad's collection. So it'll be straight out of his discography. It's along the lines, I guess you'd say, of a Jersey Boys. So, and it's not exactly his story, but it's using a lot of his experience and obviously his music to tell the story of really sort of Western swing, which originated in the South. My dad was from Alabama, and it began with country music, hillbilly music, bluegrass, and then as it began to move west, people were moving out. What's going on in California? Let's get out that way. Kind of, you know, the Texas fiddle band music then also informed it. And when it got out to California, it became a whole different thing. My dad was absolutely enamored of Django Reinhardt. And so a lot of the European swing music that you were hearing at that time, he began his career in the 30s. So we're going back a ways to give some context. But that was what they were trying to incorporate into what was more traditional country music. And so it became its own thing when it hit the West Coast. So this is a story about, you know, sort of five guys that are doing this and where they come together, but then also how they come apart at the end.
We'll look forward to hearing more about that as it progresses. I want to get to, we have less than a minute left. Yes. Creativity, why does it matter so much? You're married to a visual artist. Mm-hmm. What happens when you stop the creative flow or when you stop exploring what that has to bring into your life?
What happens? You stop being who you are. Creativity is essential. Essential. It is the language that we speak. And if you don't create, you're destroying something. Something is dying, and you're simply not speaking anymore.
Beautifully said. That is this edition of Coastline. Sydney Penny, what a pleasure having you with us today.
Thank you so much. Rachel. I love being here.
Heartfelt thanks also to Joe D'Alessandro. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or just subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.